This is Audible.
To my husband, Charles, for his unfailing support.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Glory Over Everything, Beyond the Kitchen House by Kathleen Grissom. Read by Santino Fontana with Kyle Beltran, Madeline Mabee, and Heather Alicia Sims.
I looked at my hands to see if I was the same person now I was free. There was such a glory over everything. The sun came up like gold through the trees, and I felt like I was in heaven. Harriet Tubman.
Part 1. Chapter 1. March 1830, Philadelphia. James. Robert's familiar rap on the door came as I was studying a miniature portrait of myself. The small painting, meant as a parting gift to my beloved, had just been delivered, and I was debating the artist's interpretation. I had to admit that Miss Peel's suggestion to paint my face in profile, and thus avoid the black patch covering my left eye, was a good idea. Two, she had captured my features well in this, my 33rd year. The length of my oval face, my aquiline nose, and the cleft in my square-cut jaw. But I disliked the distinct set she had given my mouth. Robert knocked again. "Yes," I called, and my butler entered. "A letter, sir," he announced, coming forward. I lifted the letter from the tray and noted the familiar script. Robert gave me a concerned glance, but a bell above the mantel clicked once, signaling that he was needed elsewhere. Fortunately, he made a quick exit. Alone again, I slit the seal. Caroline's simple words were so potent that the paper vibrated in my hand. "Darling, I will see you this evening. Your C." I had avoided her for weeks, but my presence at the event tonight was mandatory, and now Caroline meant to attend. Though I longed to see her, I was filled with dread. Time was running out, and I could no longer escape. Tonight I must tell her the truth, though in the telling I would almost certainly lose her. And to lose her was to lose my life. Again Robert was at the door, but this time, after a sharp rap, he entered on his own. He looked about uneasily, as though unsure how to deliver his next message. "What is it, Robert?" I finally asked. "Sir, there is someone here to see you," he said, his eyes scanning my person and for only the briefest moment settling on the letter. "The caller is at the back door," he added, indicating that my visitor was likely a man of color. Robert paused as though looking for words, an unusual thing for this sophisticated man who ran my household. "His name is Henry." I stiffened. Surely it cannot be Henry. We had an understanding. "He said to tell you that he is Pan's father," Robert added carefully. So it was Henry. I rose suddenly. Then, to cover my distress, I brushed at my jacket sleeves. "Have him wait in the kitchen," I ordered, until I remembered I would want complete privacy. "No, take him to my study." "Your study, sir?" Robert's eyes opened wide. My study, my private workroom, was seldom open to anyone but Robert, and that was only for cleaning. It had been that way for years. "Yes, my study," I said with some irritation, and my butler quickly took his leave. Henry waited just inside the study. I closed the wide double doors firmly behind me and carefully made my way past both drawing tables to my desk. The three tall windows in this room shed enough of the darkening light for Henry to follow. I sat and nodded toward the chair across from me, but the visitor ignored my request as his dark fingers nervously circled the frayed brown hat that he held. I was momentarily startled to see his gray hair, then remembered that years had passed since I had seen him last. He wasted no time with polite discussion and burst forth. My boy gone. My Pan gone. They take him. I know they do. You gotta help me. Please, Henry, slow down. What are you talking about? Where is Pan? What do you mean? He is missing? This the third day. All along, I'm thinking he here working in the kitchen. When he don't come see me Sunday like always, I'm thinking he needed here. But then I hear that two more boys get took from the docks. Last time I see him, I say again, you stay away from that shipyard. Those men snap you up, put you on a boat, and sell you down south. That's why I come here to see him for myself. And now Molly say he don't see Pan for 2 days and was thinking he was with me. My cook had said nothing. Why didn't Molly come to me with her concern? She say you got so much going on with selling your business and your trip coming up that you don't need to be looking out for your help. Pan is more to me than help. You know this, Henry. I knows this, Mr. Burton. You treat him real good. He getting book smart like you, and he learned to work in the white man's house. He is a quick student, I said. My boy never go off like this on his own. He comes see me direct every Sunday, then goes back Monday morning just like always. I tried to recall when I had last seen Pan. Wasn't it just yesterday that he had requested permission to take a book from my library? Or was that already 2 days ago? I'd been so distracted with my own doings. He a good boy. He don't believe nobody mean him no harm. I tell him all the time, you gotta be careful of those nigger traders. At 12 years, he just the age they looking for. They get him on a boat, take him down the river, and sell him for a slave. You know what I's talking about. Henry's voice grew loud, and I put my finger to my mouth. Henry leaned toward me and whispered loudly, "You know what I's talking about?" I did. I did know. "There's word that two more boys is missing from the South Ward, and they say that a schooner leave for the Carolinas this morning. I just know my boy's on it. You got to go get him. Pan's been telling me how you going down there on that excursion. You got to bring him back." I stopped him. "Henry, I don't leave for another month. If it is true that he was taken, how do you know that they would sell him in the Carolinas? In all likelihood, they would take him farther down." I spoke without thinking, and too late saw the effect of my words. The man's shoulders dropped. It had grown dark in the room, but I could see well enough when he wiped his eyes on the sleeve of his coat. Then he fell to his one knee. "Please, Master James, please. I only ask for help one time, and that's when I first bring my boy to you just after my Alice die. Our Pan come late to Alice and me, and now he all I got left of her. I gets you the money, you go down, get him back." His voice caught as he choked back sobs. "I know what they do to him. I's been a slave. I'd soon see him dead before I see him sold for a slave. Please, Master James, he my only boy." "Stand up, Henry," I said. "Get a hold of yourself." How could he call me by that hated title? And to be subjugating himself on his knees, had he no pride, no sense of having bettered himself? He was no longer a slave, and neither was I. I had met Henry 20 years earlier when, at the age of 13, I arrived in Philadelphia, ill and terrified and fleeing for my life. On the journey from my home in southern Virginia, I spoke to no one, mute from fear of discovery. I traveled with two secrets, one as damning as the other. The first was that just weeks before, I had discovered that I was part Negro, a race I had been taught to loathe. The second was that I had killed my father, for though I was raised by his mother as one of her own, and was as white-skinned as my father, he denied me my birthright and was going to sell me for a slave. Because of his murder, patrollers were searching for me and would hang me if I was found. I should have felt relief as I boarded each new passenger coach that took me away, but instead I became more fearful. The question of what I was going to do next loomed before me. Where would I go? How would I support myself? In my 13 years, I had never been away from home. I had been raised as a privileged white child, cared for by servants on an isolated plantation. My doting grandmother, the woman who raised me as her son, had provided me with a fair education, but she had not taught me the fundamental skills of providing for myself. Now she was dead. My home was gone, and I was alone and in great danger. When I arrived at the tavern outside of Philadelphia, I was so ill, frightened, and travel-worn that I scarcely knew to make my way inside. It wasn't until the coach horses were led back to the stables that I roused myself enough to walk into the noisy inn and ask for a bed. My head ached so that I was careless and withdrew my full purse. Then, before the transaction could take place, the smoke-filled room began to spin and my stomach heaved. I just managed to stuff the purse back into my carrying case before I hastily made for the door. Once outside, I ran for the back of the stables. There I leaned against the building as my stomach violently emptied. Then, before I could recover, I was struck from behind. I fell forward, though instinct had me clutch my traveling bag to me during the wailing that followed. In the end, the bag was wrestled from me, and with a last oath and some final kicks to my body, the thief was off. I tried to raise myself up to follow the man, but in the effort, lost consciousness. When I awoke, I was looking into Henry's dark face.
"You gotta quiet down," he said. "You yellin' too loud."
Painfully, I raised myself on my elbow to look around. I was on a pallet on the dirt floor of what appeared to be a hut. I attempted to lift myself farther, but my head throbbed so that I lay back down.
"How did I get here?" I asked.
"I find you out by the stables," he said. "Somebody work you over, but looked to me like you sick before he got to you."
"Who are you?"
I asked, squeezing my head to stop the throbbing.
"I's Henry. I work the stables back at the inn. As a runaway like you."
He stopped, then looked at me to see if I understood what he was trying to say.
"As a slave, like you,"
he said, as though to finalize a pact. His words struck me like a blow.
"I'm no slave," I protested. "What makes you say that? I'm white."
He looked at me sideways.
"Maybe you is," he said, "but that not what you say when you out of your head."
"What did I say?" I struggled again to sit up.
"Tell me, what did I say?"
"You say you was running, that somebody coming after you."
Who was this man? Had he already alerted the patrollers? Suddenly, I remembered my few belongings.
"My traveling bag," I said.
"'Fraid they got it," he said.
"Oh, no,"
I said, and defeated, I lay back down. There was nothing left. The money, the clothes, all were gone. Then another thought.
"My jacket,"
I cried out.
"Where's my jacket?"
"You mean that coat you's wearing?" Henry asked. "Even when that fever got you sweating it out, the one thing you don't let me take off of you is that coat of yours."
When Henry turned away, I reached down to feel the padded interior of my jacket where the jewelry had been sewn in. I sighed when I felt all the bumps and bulges, then I fingered the pockets, and when I felt my sketch pad and my small silver knife, I closed my eyes in relief.
"Here, it best you drink this down,"
he said, returning to me with a mug. He was on his knees beside me, and when he handed me the drink, both he and the water smelled of the earth. I drank deeply.
"Why are you doing this?" I asked. "Why are you helping me?" "Somebody helped me out when I was running like you," he said while looking me over. "You got a bad eye, or do it come from the beating you took?"
I touched my useless left eye instinctively.
"I was born with it."
Henry gave a nod.
"How long have I been here?" I asked. "You been here 4 nights," he said.
When he went for more water, I looked out on the dark night through the open door, then listened to the night sounds. They were not what I had imagined I would hear in a city.
"Where are we?"
I asked.
"We outside Philadelphia," he said. "Far enough away that nobody comes out, but close enough that I get to my work."
What did this man intend for me? Had he already turned me in?
"What are you doing out here?" I asked. "Why don't you live in the city?"
"How about you tell Henry more about you?" he said, but I closed my eyes at the thought, and before long, I fell asleep.
The next evening, I awoke to the aroma of a roasting fowl. Outdoors, I found Henry leaning over a fire and rotating our meal on a makeshift spit. When he glanced over and noticed me, he spoke.
You feeling better? He asked.
I nodded and tested myself by moving about. Though my arms and legs felt weak, my head did not throb as sharply as it had before. Henry lifted a stick and poked it twice into the hot coals. When he raised it, the spear held two crusty roasted potatoes. He set each one in a wooden bowl, then removed the perfectly browned chicken from its spit onto a slab of wood.
Sit, he said, waving me over with a dangerous-looking knife. Driven by my newly awakened hunger, I overcame my wariness and sat down across from him, watching as he used the knife to split the chicken in two. After he placed half a fowl in each bowl, he handed one to me, then set the large knife down on a flat rock between the two of us, putting it easily within my reach. The gesture gave me some relief, for I hoped it meant that he did not see me as a threat. Then I could wait no longer. I used my teeth to tear the tender meat from the bone, slurping and sucking the juice off my fingers. The potato crunched, then steamed when I bit into it, and I sputtered an oath when I burnt my mouth, causing Henry to laugh, a solid sound that came from deep within.
Boy, you something to see when you eatin', he said, shaking his head.
As my stomach filled, my worry about trusting this man was slowly replaced with curiosity. Although of average height, he was powerfully built across the shoulders. I guessed him to be close to 35 or 40 years of age. His hair grew out wild from his head, and his skin color was of the darkest I had ever seen. He was a fierce-looking man, and under ordinary circumstances, I would have given him a wide berth. When he speared another potato and handed it to me, I noted he was missing a thumb. He saw me looking and held up both his opened hands, wiggling stubs where his two thumbs once were.
They take 'em before I run.
Who did? I asked, though I wasn't certain I wanted the answer.
The master down Louisiana, Henry said.
He looked out into the dark, and speaking in a removed voice, he told me about himself. Born into slavery, he had grown up with his mother and younger brother on a large cotton plantation. The master was brutal in his handling of his slaves, and when he learned that Henry was involved in planning a revolt, he punished Henry by cutting off his thumbs and forcing him to witness his mother's flogging. She died as a result, and that was when Henry and his brother decided to make their escape.
We out by 2 days when he got shot down. Nothing for me to do but run.
He shook his head. Somehow, Henry eluded his pursuers, and after months of indescribable trials, he found himself in Philadelphia. Now, though free for 2 years, he remained on constant alert.
If that master get a hold of me, he finished me off. That's why I stay hid. Every day I's looking out, I ain't never going back to being a slave. They gotta kill me first.
He sat quiet as though exhausted from telling his story. Finally, he roused himself.
And what about you? He asked.
I was startled by his direct question. I had not expected to have him share his past so openly, and now he wanted the same from me. But how far could I trust him? Negroes were liars and thieves and always ready to take advantage of a white man. Yet so far, this one had only helped me. Dare I tell him how alone I was? Was it safe to tell him that when I fled my home, I left behind everyone and everything I cared about, knowing that I could never return?
I knows you running like me. Why you got to get away? It don't matter none to me.
I shot my father, I said quietly, hoping that he heard me, for I did not want to repeat those words.
We do what we got to do, he said. I hated him. His name was Marshall. I always thought he was my brother, but only a few months ago I found out that he was my father.
Why you thinking he your brother?
My grandmother told me that I was her son, and my dead grandfather was my father.
And what about your mama?
At the same time I found out Marshall was my father, I learned that my real mother was a Negro.
It was difficult to believe my own words, for I still loved my grandmother as my true mother.
So you take a gun to your daddy?
He was gonna sell me for a slave, I said.
You kill him dead?
Yes.
And you a nigga?
My mother was a mulatto, I said. Her name was Belle.
Was she a light color?
Yes, I said.
And your daddy was white?
I nodded. I look just like him. I'm as white as he was.
That don't matter. You still a nigger. But you can pass. That's your best bet.
I had nothing to say.
You got a family name?
Pike, I said. I'm Jamie Pike.
Not no more, he said.
You got to go by something else. I stared into the fire. How could this be? Until a few months ago, I had thought of myself as white, and now, unbelievably, I was a Negro without a name, running for my life. As my health returned, Henry's manner toward me remained genial, and because I felt no judgment of my character, I ceased judging him. In fact, I came to rely on him so much that I disliked it when he left for his work at the tavern. When I was alone, any unusual noise startled me, and I would leave it a run to hide in the trees. My heart pounded as I hid, watchful and terrified, until I would emerge, weak with relief, to realize that the disturbance had come from deer passing through or squirrels chasing one another. Daily, I feared that Rankin, the treacherous overseer from our plantation, and his son Jake, two of the most ruthless men I knew, would find me. It was almost certain that they were still searching for me, and though they were known for their dogged determination in locating runaway slaves, their notoriety came from their merciless treatment of their captives. Then, gradually, as I became familiar to the particular sounds that came from living in the woods, I adapted to Henry's primitive lifestyle. By the time we were well into the pleasant season of autumn, each morning after Henry set out for work, I quite happily spent the day in the outdoors. There, while gathering wood for our evening fire, I had the time to observe the wildlife around me. Birds were in abundance, and my childhood fascination with them grew. My interest stemmed from a large book of bird illustrations that I had been given as a child. Kept indoors for most of my early years, when I was not reading the book, I used the images to teach myself to sketch and paint. When I grew older, I used a penknife to carve birds and woodland creatures out of wood. Now, alone in this forest, I often busied myself whittling and sketching, and for those hours I was free of worries. I decided that I might remain with Henry indefinitely, but as colder weather approached, he began to suggest that it was time for me to consider my future.
You got to get into town, find some work and some place to stay, he said. Snow coming. It ain't nothing like you see before. Snow here gets deep. Hard living out here.
But what will I do? Where will I stay?
I argued, fear causing a high childish whine in my voice.
You get a job easy enough if you go in passing for white. Thing is, you do that, you gotta be careful, he said.
I didn't tell him that I had never considered anything other than presenting myself as white. I had never and would never consider myself a Negro. In fact, the idea disgusted me. Henry thought a while before he continued.
You pass. You got to cut ties with any niggas that you know.
I don't know any, I said.
There's me, he replied, but it took a while before I caught his meaning.
After I found work in Philadelphia, I took Henry's advice and we cut ties. My life progressed, and I did well for myself, establishing a place in Philadelphia society. I was alarmed then when Henry sought me out some 15 years later. He was a link to my past that could ruin me if it were exposed. I was living as a white man in white society with no affiliation to any Negroes other than those of my household staff. Yet suddenly he appeared with the request that I give employment to his 7-year-old son. I might have refused him, but after I saw his desperation and faced with the debt I owed him, I could not refuse. Thus I agreed to take in Henry's son, Pan, so he might be taught to perform the domestic duties in an established house. On our first meeting, the young son struck me as rather delicate. With his slight build, dark skin, and ears that jutted out from his thin face, Pan's unflinching brown eyes met my own, an unusual habit for one of his race, and it was there in the boy's eyes that I recognized something of myself. For all of his bravery, they held something of the fear that I had felt when I first came to Philadelphia. I agreed to provide for the boy,
but I had no intention of becoming involved with him, and turned him over to Robert, my butler, and Molly, the cook, for use in the kitchen. A few weeks after his arrival, Molly reported back to me.
"That boy, he's something. He work like I tell him to, but you never see nobody ask questions like he do. Why you do this? Why you do that? He even asked if I show him how to write down his name."
Eventually, as Robert gave him more chores, I began to see Pan around the house more frequently. He was an uncommonly cheerful child, and when he saw me, he'd enthusiastically call out, "Hello, Mr. Burton!" And he didn't leave it at that. Almost always his greetings included other comments, such as,
"Did you see my new shoes?"
Or,
"I'm sure getting plenty to eat."
His demeanor was so winning that in spite of myself, I began to take notice of him. Then came the day he found me cleaning the cage of my much-prized cockatoo, Malcolm. When Pan opened the door to my upstairs room, his eyes opened wide.
"What you doing with that bird?" he asked.
"I'm caring for him," I said.
"Ain't he supposed to be outside?"
He looked back out the door.
"Does Robert know you got him in here?"
Malcolm flew to Pan's shoulder, and though the boy stiffened, he stood his ground. When the bird began to nose Pan's ear, the boy did not move but rolled his eyes up at me.
"He gone hurt me?"
"No, I rather think he likes you," I said. Malcolm leaped onto his favorite perch with a questioning squawk. Pan stared.
"I sure never do see something like him before."
"His name is Malcolm, and he is a salmon-crested cockatoo."
"Where did you get him?"
"He was my first friend when I came to this house," I said, surprising myself with my open answer.
"You're naughty boy,"
Malcolm interrupted, using his favorite phrase. Pan gaped, then gave a nervous laugh.
"That him talking?"
"It is," I said.
"That bird was talking?"
"Yes, he mimics very well." The boy clapped his hands.
"Make him talk again."
His interest in the bird reminded me of myself as a child, and I decided to give him an opportunity. "I'll tell you what. You have Robert send you to me every day at this time, and I will teach you how to take care of him. Then you can hear him speak every day."
"You saying you let me help you out with this bird?"
"That's what I'm saying."
"Won't be no work for me," he said. "But Robert don't want me fooling around the house outside of the kitchen, lest he say so."
"I'll speak with Robert," I promised. It wasn't long before Pan was supplying Malcolm with the sycamore and dogwood branches that the bird loved to gnaw. And after the boy discovered how to keep Malcolm occupied, I often found the bird happily nipping at a swinging ear of corn or pecking at a carrot that hung above his perch. Pan continued to surprise me with his quick mind, and because of his keen desire to learn, in time I began to teach him to read and write. One late afternoon, less than a year after his arrival, he stood beside my desk while once again I attempted to correct his use of the English language. As I was doing so, he leaned over to catch my eye.
"Mr. Burton, why are you doing this for me?" he asked.
"Why are you doing this for me?" I corrected.
"Yes, Mr. Burton, you right. Why are you doing this for me?"
he repeated my correction. "You are right," I corrected again.
"I know I's right," he said.
Then he repeated himself again.
"I say, why are you doing this for me?"
"Can you be more explicit?" I asked. When I saw the confusion on his face, I worded the question another way. "What do you mean to ask when you say, why are you doing this for me? What do you think that I am doing for you?"
"You a white man helping out a nigger child. You teaching me how to talk white like you. Why you doing this? Why you fooling with me?"
His earnest gaze touched me, and I was stung by his honest question. I turned away and felt for my handkerchief, then blew my nose. After folding my handkerchief, I was about to replace it when, without asking, Pan took it from me. He leaned forward.
"Look at me,"
he said, and with his small hand he reached over and pulled my chin to face him. Then with supreme care he used the cloth to dab away a droplet of water that had slipped from under my eye patch.
"That eye weepin',"
he said. I was so touched that I rose and went to stand before a shelf of books, feigning interest while I composed myself. He waited until I was seated again.
"That eye hurt you much?" he asked.
Does your eye pain you? I corrected. He gave a deep sigh.
Mr. Burton, you keep stopping me, telling me how to talk. I don't ever get a chance to hear what you got to say.
He protested, then looked puzzled when I chuckled. As time passed, Pam continued to help Robert around the house and Molly in the kitchen. Molly's only complaint now was his constant correction of her grammar, but increasingly, I called on him to assist me with my many projects. In his eagerness to understand, he was filled with questions and freely shared his observations. His carefree countenance broke through my guarded reserve, and over the next 5 years, I came to care deeply for the boy. But now he was missing. Could it be that he was stolen for a slave? It was a constant fear among the Negroes of Philadelphia, for it happened often. I imagined how desperate Henry must feel, as I recalled his own terror at being taken again for a slave. The thought of Pam meeting with this fate filled me with dread. He was quick-witted but had always been frail and surely could not survive the hard life of a slave. If he had been stolen, he must be retrieved. And since I was traveling south for my work, could I not do so? Yet the thought of it, the idea of deliberately exposing myself to people who bought and sold Negroes, terrified me. I had worked hard for the last 15 years to move away from my past toward safety. And now the leaden ball of fear, one that had receded but had never truly left me, began again to grow.
Chapter 2 1825 Pan. After my mama passed, Daddy got no place for me to go. So one Sunday he brings me to Mr. Burton's house. How my daddy knows this white man, he never say. He just tell me to keep my mouth shut while he do the talking. We go round to the back door where a black man, dressed slick, names Robert, comes to the kitchen and takes us to what he calls the study. That place, I never seen nothing like it. It's full of books and dead birds. While we's waiting, I take hold of my daddy's hand to stop it from shaking, but I know him good enough not to say nothing. Soon as Mr. Burton walks in, I see he don't want nothing to do with us. My daddy pushed me ahead. Mr. Burton, my daddy say, this here Pan. Mr. Burton looks down at me, then looks back up at my daddy like he don't know what to say. I never asked you for nothing, but now I's asking you to take in my boy, says my daddy. Henry, you know I am indebted to you, but he's too young, and I don't have need of more help. I would be happy to give you a purse if that would help you out. I'm not here for no money. I'm here 'cause my boy need work and a place to stay. His mama died last week and now she gone. He got nobody. My daddy's voice starts to shake and I grab hold of his hand. He still can't talk about my mama leaving us without crying. He holds tight to my hand and starts talking again. My boy can't stay in town by himself and I's still working out of town like before, so he can't stay with me. Mr. Burton looks down at me. How old are you? I'm guessing this man only got one good eye, 'cause he got a black patch covering up the other one. But with the look he gives me, he only need the one. Tell him, boy, Daddy says, bumping my shoulder. I's 8 years old, I say loud, knowing my daddy count on me to speak up. You appear small for 8 years, Mr. Burton says. I don't wait for Daddy to poke me again. Not too small to carry in wood, I say. Carry in water, too, you needs it. Mr. Burton look up at my daddy. Isn't he too young to stay here on his own? My daddy talks quick. He old enough to stay. He work hard, don't need nothing but a place to sleep, something to eat, and somebody to show him what to do. I come get him every Sunday morning, see he get back by Sunday evening. No need for me to come in the house. Then he looks down at me. You ready to stay here and work, isn't you, Pan? I is, I say real loud, making my daddy nod to Mr. Burton. Nobody say nothing for a while, then Mr. Burton say, Henry, I owe you. We'll give it a try, but if by next Sunday the boy doesn't work out, you must take him back with you, and I will give you a purse. My daddy don't say nothing, but turns and goes and leaves me standing there. Him going like that makes it look like he don't care, but I know better. He just no good at saying goodbye. Mr. Burton calls Robert in. They both stand there looking my way, like they's trying to figure me out. I don't like it that quiet. Where's the work? I say. They look at each other, then Mr. Burton smile like I say something funny. Can you find some simple tasks to keep him occupied? Mr. Burton asks Robert. I'll have to give it some thought, says Robert, the slick man. He's too young to be capable of much. What he know? I've been taking care of my mama right through the week, till when my daddy gets back in town every Sunday. My mama say I's real handy to have around, I say. But don't you want to stay with your father? Mr. Burton asked. He tried taking me with him to the tavern, but they say he gotta get rid of me or he's out of job, I say. And you won't miss him? Mr. Burton asked. He comes see me every Sunday, just like he do when Mama's still here. Your mother recently died. Nah, she don't die. She just released herself from her earthly body, just like she keep telling me she gotta do. But she with me right now. We just can't see her. The two men look at each other again. Mr. Burton take in air and let it out real slow. Robert, take him into Molly. Ask her to give him a room and set him up with a few light chores. I suppose you could learn to polish silver, the slick man says, taking a hold of my shoulder and steering me downstairs. This house so big, I don't know how I ever gonna find my way around. The room off the kitchen that Molly puts me in to sleep is bigger than the room that I was living in with my mama. After Molly says to get to sleep and then closes the door on me, I start crying. I miss my daddy, but most I miss the way my mama always kissed my face goodnight, smooching on me until I tell her to stop. I just want to feel her kissing on me one more time. I'm scared here by myself. This big house is too quiet. I was used to hearing noise at night. Those my age out running the streets, shouting each other. Men drinking, gambling, laughing with each other, and women, too, that fool with the men's. Some nights they get to fighting, and I get afraid they're coming in, so after Mama throws the bolt, she takes a chair and sits in front of the door, telling me that anybody come in, they gotta first get past her. Then I can sleep. My mama was never too big, but she got plenty of fight in her when it comes to looking out for me. Why don't we tell Daddy he gotta stay with us? I ask at those times. He doing the best he can do, she always say. But why don't he stay? I ask. Child, he bring us his half dollar every Sunday that pays the rent. We got nothing to complain about. He brings us the money, then why you gotta take in all the sewing the way you do? I ask. How you think we gonna eat? How we pay for that wood to cook up the grits and to make a fire when it get cold? You look round you. How many does you see shivering when it's snowing outside and they don't got the clothes to cover up? Don't you members last winter when we go over to see Mr. Woods and he... Don't, Mama, I say. Don't talk about that. I don't like to think of that man we found laying on the dirt floor of his room with nothing but a small rag covering his dead self, and his woman sitting there crying about what she gonna do now. There's lots of people out there like Mr. Woods, she said. Your daddy always makes sure we got a good room with a fire and a roof over our head. But why don't he live with us? I keep asking. Till one day she sits me down. Next time your daddy here, you watch the way he keeps on his feet. You ever see him sit? No, you don't, and I gonna tell you why. He always be ready to go. He run from being a slave, and he think they coming to take him back. He got work outside of Philadelphia at the tavern where all the coaches stop. By watching out who coming into town, he think that he gonna see if anybody come looking for him. Here in town, your daddy always afraid somebody gonna see him and send word to his old master. So why don't we go live with him? I ask. Out in the woods, Henry keep moving round, case somebody get wind of him. And he don't want us there if he gets picked up. He afraid they get us, too, sell us for slaves. And we don't want to be no slaves like daddy. Sheila say slaves is low down. Son, I don't want to hear you say that no more. The word slave don't mean somebody's bad. Plenty of folks around here come from being a slave. It mean that somebody got a hold of you and you don't have no say. Your daddy can't help once being a slave. There's no shame in that. There's only shame in the man who used him like that. That first night in Mr. Burton's house, I'm wondering where my daddy is, but I go to sleep crying for my mama. The next morning I wake up, sun's coming in the small window that sits over my bed. Real quick, I pull on my clothes and get myself out into the kitchen, but Molly's already working at the stove. You should have woke me up so I can get to work, I say, afraid Mr. Burton will find out and send me back. Come over here and get yourself something to eat, Molly says, and sits me down at the table, then sets a plate of 2 eggs with a big slice of ham in front of me. I sit quiet and wait for her to come back and take out what she gonna eat. She looks over at me. Go ahead, she says, nodding at the plate. How much of this do I get to eat? I say. That is all for you. I got to eat all this? What you going to eat? What Robert going to eat? Child, she says, we already got our food. You go ahead now and eat up. I'll give you some milk when you finish. I dig in with the spoon, but when I lift the meat with my fingers, Molly comes over. Here, she says, this is how we work it in this house. She cuts the meat with a knife, then gives me a fork to spear it. I never do see 2 eggs on a plate like this before. Eggs is hard to come by, and even though some folks keep chickens, they don't stay for long because they get eat up. I'm done eating, my stomach all puffed out, when Robert comes in. Quick, I get off my chair to show him I was ready to work. He looks me over, then goes over to a hook on the wall and takes down a big green apron that he ties around himself. We have our work cut out for us, he says. I found some suitable clothes, but first we must get you scrubbed clean. But you washed me last night, I say to Robert. And today you shall have a full bath, he says. I ask if I should start to carry in the water. Like he don't hear me, Robert just goes over and turns on an inside spigot that's right there in the kitchen, and water starts pouring out. He puts it in 2 big kettles, and while he's waiting for it to get hot, he has me stand on a stool so he can cut my hair. I keep looking at that spigot. I'm glad if it means I don't have to carry in water, 'cause it gets heavy. After Mama got sick and she couldn't lift no more, I carried the water in from the outside spigot that everybody get to use. The water for washing was always cold, and we didn't waste the wood just to heat it up, except for in the winter when the fire was already going. Carrying in the water was heavy, so I brought in just a half a bucket every time I made the trip, and Mama always says that was enough. Even though she'd stand at the door and watch for me, I didn't like to go out in the alley past the heaps of dirt piled up and the rats big as cats digging in everybody's slop. The winters wasn't as bad 'cause the piles was froze and the smell wasn't so strong. But when it got to warming up, the folks like Mr. Woods, who lived out there in the rooms close to the outhouse, they had a stink. Why you gotta cut my hair? I asked Robert. Because you've got hair that makes you look like a wild dog, he says. I do, I say. What kind of wild dog? He don't say nothing and just keeps cutting. When he's done, I tell him my ears feel cold, but I don't know that he hears me because he's busy pouring the hot water from the stove into a big wash tub and then tells me to get in. You telling me to step in there? I ask, watching the steam lift up. Remove your clothes, he says. So I take off my shirt real slow, not liking this one bit. Now your pants, he says, and I look over at Molly. It don't seem like she looking my way, so I get out of my pants and jump in the water quick, but it's too hot to sit. Sit down, Robert says. I'm gonna cook, I say, trying not to yell out when he pushes me down. What you doing to me, I ask when right away he starts soaping me and scrubbing away like Mama do with the pig's feet before she cook 'em. Stay still, he says, pouring water over me, but when my eyes start burning from the soap, I grab at him and pull myself up. I can't see nothing, I can't see nothing, I say, forgetting not to be loud. He cleans the soap from my eyes, then gives me a big rag to dry myself off before he hands me my new clothes. Where'd you get these clothes? I asked. How'd you get them to fit me? The white shirt and the brown pants, even though they's too long, look almost good as his. He don't say nothing, but leans down and rolls up the pants, and while I still got them on, he stitches them up. Then he stands back, looking at me, before he gives me some black shoes to put on. I never have shoes before, just an old pair of boots that Mom and me both use when we go out in winter. The shoes feel funny. They's too small, I say. They squeezing me in. They are fine, he says, and I don't want to see you without them. Robert takes me upstairs to show me how to clean out the fireplaces and to set a fire. There's 5 rooms we go to, and I stick close to him, wondering how we ever gonna find our way back. But he do. Back in the kitchen, he sets me up in a small room where he shows me how to clean boots. First, you gotta take off all the dirt with a brush, then you stir up what's called the blacking, and then you use another brush to put it on the boots. What's in that stuff? I ask, not sure if I like the smell. Some sweet oil, some beer, some molasses. I already taste molasses, I say. Well, don't go tasting this, he says, then shows me how to finish up with the last brush that he calls the polisher. After he goes, I get to work and keep working, even though my arms is about to drop off, until Molly comes out and tells me it's time to eat. We gonna eat again? I say, 'cause it's the middle of the day. Come on, she says, and sets me down at the table with another plate of food. This time it's fried potatoes and a whole pork sausage. She sits down across from me and starts eating at her own plate, but I just can't take in all that food. I keep looking at it till I start sniffling. You crying, Charles? She asks. What, you don't like Molly's cooking? I like your cooking. Well, then, what's troubling you? I'm thinking about my mama. I just wish she was here to be tasting some of this. Nothing would make your mama happier than if you start eating so as you could get yourself back to work, Molly says. How about I save it till later, I ask. I'm going to be hungry then. That'd be fine, she said. But you sit here a while. Maybe you change your mind. I don't know what to do, so I just sit there watching her eat and looking up at the small green flowers on the red rag that she got tied up round her head. Molly's got a big head, but then she's got a lot bigger all around, and I'm guessing it's all the food she gets to eat. Mmm, she says, I sure do like this sausage. She got big brown eyes, and I like the way they look at me. Potatoes good, too, she says. The onions and the butter make them taste real good. You sure you don't want some? No, I say. I keep mine for later. Just so you know, long as you're here, you get all the food you want, she says. When she finishes her food, she sits back and drinks some coffee from a blue and white china cup. You want some milk? She asks. But I say, no, my stomach is still big from eating them two eggs. She tips up her cup and finishes her drink, then pushes back from the table and stands up. Well, you go on then, she says. Get back to polishing those boots. That night when Molly sends me to bed, I ask if I can leave the door open so I can call out to her if I need something. She say that fine by her, and not long after I hear her snoring, so it ain't so quiet. And even though I still cry for my mama, I get to sleep easier. Next day, I get up before the sun, and I'm waiting for her and Robert in the kitchen when they show up. Give me some work, I say, afraid that if they don't get me going, Mr. Burton send me off. So Molly gets me to carry in wood and sweep the floor. When it's time to eat, she hands me a plate with two eggs and some warm biscuits that got butter dripping off. I eat it all, even though my stomach rumbling because it don't know what to do with all this food. Then she sets me up to help her wash the pots and pans.
Chapter 3 1830 James. It was dark after Henry left, and in my dressing room, Robert had already put flame to the candle sconces on my tall cheval mirror. I slipped off my day coat and draped it carefully over the back of the tapestry-covered armchair, yet another fine piece of furniture that I had inherited after Mrs. Burton died. But this night, appreciation for what my adopted parents had given me was overridden by my worry. In fact, I was so filled with concern that I, a man who was always punctual, sat down in the chair knowing full well I was already behind schedule and that tonight a late entry would not do. To blend into this aristocratic society, through the years I had painstakingly studied the unwritten rules. Knowing when to arrive and, as important, when to take leave was only the beginning. Whom to greet, whose hand to take, the clothes to wear, the gift to send, all reflected back, and that, for me, left no room for error. But tonight, for the first time in a long while, I questioned if I could meet the challenge. This evening's event, hosted at the home of leading society members Mr. and Mrs. Carden, was meant as a celebration for artists awarded grants from the Peel Museum. Most of the attention would fall on known artists, and though I was one of the minor recipients, my appearance was required. I should have been eager to attend, yet I sat, head in hands. Pan's disappearance and Henry's visit had raised buried fears. When the museum offered to fund an art excursion, I leaped at the opportunity. Their support was given so I might travel south along the coastline to study the natural habitat of birds native to that region. If on my return my work was approved, it would result in a small book for print, meant for travelers to better identify bird species. Now, after Henry's visit, I questioned my quick decision to accept. In the 20 years since I had escaped Virginia, time had dulled my fears. But when faced with Henry's alarm about Pan's disappearance, I was reminded of the dangers that might await me in those southern slave states. Might I be recognized? Was it possible that patrollers were still searching for me? Why hadn't I considered my safety more carefully? Yet these worries came too late, for I was committed, and there was no turning back. My anxiety about the evening only increased when I considered another concern, one as troubling as my first. It was Caroline. I was torn, for seeing her again would mean an end to the agony of our separation. But in what state would I find her? She had every right to be furious that I had stayed away. I heard the clock strike and forced myself to my feet. Quickly, I removed my clothes, then shivered as I lowered myself into the bath. For though there was heat from the fireplace, the water had already cooled in the metal tub. I had no sooner soaped myself than Robert entered, bearing a large bucket of steaming water. "I was hoping you would wait," he said. "I am already late." "Yes, sir," he replied, slowly and carefully pouring in the hot water so I could rinse myself clean. I stepped out to catch hold of the bath blanket that Robert held, then dried myself while he stood by, ready with a fresh white shirt. As I pulled on my clean drawers and my dress pants, then tucked in my shirt, Robert clicked his tongue. "Sir, we have not done your manicure." I glanced at my hands. "It will have to do," I said, buttoning my trousers. From behind, he fastened my galluses, then placed them over my shoulders so I could button them in the front. As Robert expertly tied my cravat, I took in some deep breaths. "I would cancel the whole trip," I said, "if I were not obligated to go." "Yes, sir." "And now I've promised Henry that I will search for Pan." "I understand," he said, "though the boy was warned not to go down to the shipyards." "Then why would he have gone?" Robert hesitated while buttoning my blue satin waistcoat. "What is it?" I asked. "Tell me." "Molly said he came to her requesting money," Robert said. "For what purpose?" "The boy said that he wanted to buy you a parrot." "What? Why would he want to do that?" "He told Molly that he wanted to see you happy again." My chest thumped. Only Pan would have considered me in this way. That foolish, foolish boy. I had a sudden chill. Until that moment, I had held out hope that he might safely resurface. But I knew that to find a bird, he would have gone down to the docks. Didn't Molly warn him? She didn't consider that he might go to the shipyards. She thought that all birds were sold down in the market. Robert held up my black tailcoat, indicating that he needed me to hold on to my shirt sleeves. "If we hurry, you will not be that late," he said. I held out my arms as Robert slipped my coat up and over my shoulders. He fooled with the collar until, impatient, I turned around to see myself reflected in the mirror. I stepped closer, using my fingers to pull my damp brown hair forward in loose curls, while Robert used a hairbrush to smooth the close-cut hair at the back of my head. I slipped on the black satin eye patch, though tonight I gave my useless eye little thought when I saw the lines of concern on my face. Those must be erased. This evening was meant to be a celebration, and I was expected to look the part of a joyous recipient. I reminded myself again that traveling as a funded artist would allow me to gain entry into homes that otherwise would not have been open to me. And now I would need every opportunity to find Pan. It was not until I was settled in the carriage and well on my way that I allowed myself to think of Caroline. Then my heart raced. For though telling my truth would likely end our affair, I could not wait to see her again.
Chapter 4. 1825. Pan. I like working with Molly in the kitchen. We get along good. But Robert, he another story. All he cares is that I scrubbed up like him and working hard. He don't let me go with my daddy on Sunday unless I got on a clean shirt and my new shoes polished like his. I can tell my daddy happy to see me all dressed like I'm somebody, working big time for the white folk. You doing all right, boy? He asks every Sunday when he comes, and I tell him I is. Then I tell him about everything that happens to me. He listens good, except when I start talking about my mama. One day, when we were sitting in the trees and looking out over the water, finishing up what Molly gives us to eat, I start wondering to him if Mama's seeing us and what she's wanting to say. He shake his head and look over at me. You a talker, boy, just like your mama. And that's all right by me, but I don't want to hear you talk about her no more. She gone. But Daddy, I say, she always gonna be with us. She tell me all the time. She say, Pan, I don't want to hear nothing about her no more. That fine, Daddy. I don't need to say nothing more, just that she's still here, that's all. You know she gone, Daddy say. She's still here. She say she always gonna stay with me. My eyes start stinging, but I don't cry, cause my daddy don't like it when I do. He gives me a look, but don't say nothing for a long time. Just don't go talking like that to nobody else, he say. I already say so to Mr. Burton. You do? I nod. What do you say? Nothing. Nothing? Nope, he don't say nothing. My daddy look out over the water. Just don't go telling nobody else. Some gulls dip down across the water. That reminds me how I'm helping Mr. Burton out with his bird, and I say so. My daddy look at me like I'm making up a story. What bird? He ask. He got this bird that talks good as you and me, I say. Mr. Burton say that I'm good with birds, and I got to help him out because Molly, she afraid that bird gonna bite her, and Robert, he don't want nothing to do with it. What else they got you doing? Mr. Burton, he's showing me how to write. He do? And he's showing me how to read. That's good, son. You watch close and don't talk so much. Mr. Burton say that asking questions is a good thing. That's how you learn, he say. Well, that man don't get where he is today without being a smart man. I nod. He sure do know everything about birds, and he tell Robert that I don't need to wear shoes all the time until my feet stop hurting so bad. How do you know your feet was hurting? Daddy asks. I tells him. You troubling Mr. Burton that your feet hurting you? No, just when I can't step right and he asks me why, I say, 'cause Robert says I got to wear shoes all the time, and my feet ain't taking to him the way they should. Daddy shake his head. Just don't go bothering the man with too much talking about yourself. Only time I talk about myself is if he asks me something. He asks you about me? No, just why I can't stay with you. And I tells him that a tavern is no place for a child, and that you don't want me round the barns on my own. I tell him you take Mama's leaving us real hard, and that I tell you not to worry, 'cause I know she's watching out for us. Daddy shoots me a look, then picks up the basket from Molly and stands to go. That's him telling me enough talk. We walk back with me quiet, but I take his hand and know he's not mad with me because he squeezed my hand real tight.
Chapter 5 1830 James. I arrived an hour later than the invitation called for. To say Mr. and Mrs. Carden's home was magnificent would not be an exaggeration. Yet the size of this Georgian home, their city dwelling, was said to be dwarfed by the size of their country estate. Mr. Burton, good to see you again, sir. I thanked Felix, greeting by name their gray-haired Negro servant, as I handed over my greatcoat, hat, and gloves. You know your way, he said, nodding toward the stairway. I do, I said, but hesitated while I tried to gather my reserves. How I disliked the feel of dampness around the stiff cotton of my collar. Over the years, I had learned to hide uncertainty under the cover of sophistication, but tonight I was too unsettled, too shaken. I looked down the long hallway, and though I was not a drinking man, I wondered if I might go first into the back library to pour myself a quick brandy. However, with the arrival of another carriage and more guests about to fill the foyer, I decided to forego the temptation and went instead to climb the broad and winding red-carpeted stairway that led to the ballroom. The usual gaming tables were set up in the outer room, and many people were already at play. It was excruciating to hold back,